Today is Monday, December 28th, 2009. I'm Laurel Nemi, your host for The Wildlife, a program that probes the mysteries of the animal world through interviews with scientists and other wildlife investigators. Today on The Wildlife, I'll talk with former Vermonter Nancy Basilchuk, a freelance science writer and editor now living in Norway who used to work the environmental beat at the Burlington Free Press. In the spirit of the season, we'll talk about wild reindeer, her search to find them on a dramatic cross-country ski trek in Norway, and whether these animals really can fly. But first, let me play you today's creature call. For this week's creature call, I'll stay right here in Vermont, where this common mammal lives. The sound you're about to hear is the sound these animals make to intimidate others of their kind and prevent fights. Now, listen carefully and see if you can guess today's creature call. At the end of the show, I'll play these sounds again, tell you what kind of animal made them, and also give you a preview of next week's creature call. Now, let me turn to my conversation on reindeer with Nancy Basilchuk. You may know Ms. Basilchuk from her writing at the Burlington Free Press, where she worked the environmental beat and covered topics such as land use controversies, invasive species, and hazardous waste sites. Since 2003, she's been based in Norway working as a freelance science writer and editor. She's written for numerous publications, including The New Scientist, Scientific American, and Audubon Magazine. In fact, I first became interested in reindeer after reading an article she wrote that appeared in the November-December 2008 issue of Audubon Magazine. That article, which was called Snow Patrol, described a cross-country ski trek Nancy made with her family to see wild reindeer in one of Norway's snowy, windswept national parks. When I spoke with Nancy Basilchuk last week, I asked her what first interested her in making this expedition.
Well, I have to be honest, partly it was because I've always, this national park where the largest herd of wild reindeer in Europe live, which is, this park is called Hardangervidda National Park, and I love polar explorers. I'm really fascinated by polar explorers, and Roald Amundsen, you know, I write about him in my story. He tried to cross Hardangervidda because it's this high mountain plateau. It's not really mountainous, but it's pretty high. It averages about maybe 4,000 feet, but it's flat and it's subjected to incredible weather. So Roald Amundsen tried to cross it before he went to the South Pole in 1911-1912, and he failed twice. He tried to cross it twice.
He tried twice, really?
Yeah, nobody talks about the first one, but the second one's more famous because he wrote about it in his biography, and I only wrote about his second attempt in my article. But so I was like, my God, I can't believe. You know, he skied 1,000 miles or something to get to Antarctica and get to the South Pole and back. You know, this is not a man to be trifled with. And I thought, how can this be, So I've always wanted to ski there. And having the reindeer there is also this major attraction because it's this huge herd. And you can't live in Norway and be sort of not be interested in, and be, if you're interested in the out of doors and you live in Norway, reindeer are sort of an inevitable interest because in addition to the 25,000 wild reindeer that live throughout Norway, there's another 200,000 domestic animals here.
200,000 domestic animals. Domestic
yeah,
reindeer.
Yeah, a lot.
Wow.
Yeah, but they're mostly up north, but so it's not that so you can see them. You know, you can, and it's pretty cool. It's pretty cool to see them.
Wow, and so once you learned he hadn't succeeded in this, that immediately made you think, oh, I want to go there.
Yeah. Well, it's a lot more civilized now. I mean, when he went, it was literally this unmapped. I mean, it was not a place that people went in the winter because the weather is just so. There's nothing to stop the wind, and it can be bitterly cold. In fact, the year before we skied across Hardangervidda, two Scotsmen died.
Oh, really? Which increases your wanting to go.
I know it's no, but you know you have to be. So it's nothing. It's not to be trifled with. But there are huts. I mean, that's one thing that I write about in my story, and that's one thing that really makes it possible is that there are these huts. You know, the Norwegian Trekking Association, which is this sort of semi-volunteer group of it's this association of different regional groups that maintain these fabulous mountain huts. So they're scattered. You know, they're about a day's ski apart. So it's still, you know, once you're out there, when you're between huts, you're out there, and you know you have to, like, we carried gear prepared to stay out at night if in case, you know, if like the weather came down or we couldn't see, because you're up on this plateau. There's no trees.
I'm picturing it like the great, you know, like the Russian steppes, and you know, as depicted in all sorts of movies, just sort of harsh, wind blown. What's it look like?
It's very white, and just it seems like the horizon is a zillion miles away, you know, and it's usually fringed by the peaks that are on the edge of the plateau. But it's like you feel like you are, I think it's probably the closest I could be to skiing in Antarctica or skiing across Greenland. It's really an amazingly open, just beautifully remote place. It's so cool. It's really gorgeous. It's really nice. So, and that's the other reason I really wanted to go, because I think it's so, I mean, there are people there, especially Easter time, which is when we were there, which is when you really want to go. You know, you wouldn't go this time of year. First of all, it's pitch black most of the time, you know, because the sun doesn't come up for very long at these latitudes. And
so right now the sun is rising right now in late December. It's rising at, what you said, 10 in the morning,
10 o'clock. Well, where I am, yeah, in Hardangervidda, it might be rising a little earlier. So it's coming up at about 10 and it's going down at 2:30. So, and where I live in Trondheim, which is north of where we were skiing in Hardangervidda, but where I live, you know, we're still 300 miles south of the Arctic Circle. But of course, above the Arctic Circle, it's just dark. It's just dark all the time. Although what you get is you get this really, even here, you get this incredibly rich, rosy light, because the sun, when it goes down, it sort of slips down behind the horizon for a while. You know, it doesn't just like disappear. And so you get these very long, beautiful twilights. It's really, the light is very rich.
And then you said you were there around Easter time in March or April?
Yeah, we were there. Yeah, and that's when most people go to ski.
And how long is daylight then?
It depends upon when Easter is, of course. But it was much, you know, it was much more like 10 hours. Or so. I mean, it was getting longer. I mean, when is the solstice?
Yeah.
So it was a much more normal length of day. So you wouldn't have to worry about. That's another good reason to go when, after, you know, right around spring solstice and so forth. So,
and then in so the reindeer. I'll just I understand there are two major groups of reindeer, which are, they're also called caribou, right?
Well, right. They call them caribou in on your side of the. Of that big tunnel.
And so you have the tundra reindeer, and then that has six subspecies. And then you also have woodland reindeer with three subspecies. And
right.
So and what kind are in Norway? Do you know?
Well, we call them mountain reindeer. Mm-hmm. Rangifer tarandus. And then also in Norway, actually, it's really interesting. There's this other subspecies in Svalbard. I don't know if you know about Svalbard. It's this island archipelago about 500 miles south of the North Pole.
Oh, wow.
That's about right. Yes, and it's a territory that's essentially a part of Norway, and there is this other subspecies of, reindeer there that's adapted to the much harsher, I mean, that's so far, so very far. north.
And that's a special subspecies found only in Svalbard?
Yeah, and they have like their bodies are small. You know, their bodies are much smaller. You know, they have really short legs because there isn't a lot of snow up there, surprisingly not. And they're also essentially there are no carnivores, so they don't have any reason to be able to run all that fast. So they're really they look very different. They look like sort of miniature.
Oh, really?
Reindeer. Yeah.
So reindeer, I know they live, you know, in Northern Europe, Siberia, and North America. And I was interested in preparing for this interview to learn that in North America, the range used to go as far south as central Idaho and the Great Lakes, and also northern New England right here in Vermont. And so, but today, of course, you can only find wild populations in Alaska, Canada, Washington State, and northern Idaho. And then in Europe, you have wild populations in Norway, Finland, and Russia. And I'm just wondering, are they all over Norway or just in certain spots?
Well, the wild reindeer are actually most of them are actually in southern Norway, as odd as that seems, since we think of them as a species, you know, like we associate them with ice and snow. But, of course, all of Norway is so very far north, even south of where even southern Norway is way far north. and it really has to do with habitat. You know, they are lichen specialists. You know, they're especially adapted to eat this type of plant, which is a symbiotic plant.
It's a special lichen that can you find
well,
it?
Well, they eat all lichen. They eat okay. All lichens that grow on the tundra.
Uh-huh.
And so they have to be in places where in the winter, for example, that represents about 80% of their food.
Wow.
So they have got to be able to get to that. And actually that's the really cool thing about Hardangervidda, for example. It's a perfect place for reindeer because of the way that the weather interacts in the winter and the spring and so forth. So in the winter, they're over on the, if you think of Hardangervidda as this like big round national park.
Okay.
Then what happens is that the reindeer, in the winter, they're over sort of on the eastern side of the park, which is sort of farther away from the ocean. The western side of the park is closer to the ocean. In fact, you know, some of the fjords come right up towards the park, and you can see the fjord. You can see fjords from the top of the big glacier that's in Hardangervidda National Park, Hardangerjökull. So in the west, there's access. There's a lot of moisture coming off the ocean. There's a lot of snow, so there's heavy snowfall, and the reindeer don't want to be in the heavy snowfall in the winter because they have to paw through the snow to get to the lichen that they can eat.
Okay.
So they winter in the eastern part where the snowfall is lower, and it's easier for them to get food. And then what they do is they head west as they sort of follow the melting snow, and they get the young plants that are that are blooming right after the snow melts away, and they get the fresh green shoots. So they sort of follow this thawing snow and the spring as it sort of erupts on the tundra to get the best possible food.
That's interesting.
Yeah,
how deep is the snow? You said, you know, because the snow falls lower in the eastern part of the park, but it's not low, or is it low?
No. Well, it depends. I mean, what they tend to do is, in the valleys, of course, it can be quite deep. I mean, I think over the park overall, the average is something like 10 feet of snow.
Okay, not 10 inches, 10 feet of snow.
No, 10 feet. No, but... But of course, it's not like an even blanket. And what the reindeer tend to do is they tend to feed, like they'll look for windblown ridges or windblown spots that make the snow cover quite thin, so they can just paw through this very thin snow cover. because whatever little depressions or valleys there are in this big plateau is where the wind will blow the snow and it'll collect there. So it's not flat like a pancake flat. You know, it's been cut by rivers and by there is relief, but it's not like huge mountains. It's more like rolling terrain that's been cut by rivers and.
Sounds stunning.
It really is. It is really just an amazing thing to be out there on skis and, you know, all you hear is the wind blowing and, you know, the sound of your skis against the snow and maybe like, you know, you see your family ahead of you and then everything else, it's just white and blue sky and it's so amazing. And not, you know, you feel like you're in the middle of nowhere. It's really great.
And I know that reindeer are superbly adapted to the Arctic conditions and that they can run, you had said in your article, they can run 28 miles per hour.
Yeah.
About the same as a grizzly bear. I was stunned for that. And I'm just wondering how, you know, what about their other adaptations? You know, how can they travel across that deep snow?
Well, you know, they have these feet. They have these, you know, they're ruminants. So they have cloven hooves, but the hooves are quite curved. They're almost they're almost like half moon shaped, and they're almost like they're not like snowshoe hare types, but they are. There is an adaptation there that enables them to travel more. That spreads their weight better. Enables them to travel more easily on the snow. And they've got, you know, they've got their coat is, I don't know, I guess I have this one document here that says their coat is extremely thick and heavy. They've got three times the number of guard hairs, which are like the, you know, hollow hairs that have air in them, so they're insulating. They have about 700 hair per square centimeter.
Really?
Yeah, if you want to know, somebody actually counted that.
I probably know the people who have. No.
Yeah, right, and also they have a second, like, you know, like a dog has an undercoat that the reindeer also have an undercoat which is extremely extremely dense, and this undercoat in the winter it grows longer than it grows quite long, and it enables them to lie on the snow. They don't get wet. So they really, I mean, they're sort of wrapped in this very thick, pelt, I guess you would call it, but it is really, I mean, we're out there on skis and, you know, dressed up. And when we stop, we have to put on like down jackets and stuff because the wind or we have to build, like to stop for lunch, we would cut little blocks of snow and make little snow shelters, because if not, you're just freezing because the wind the wind blows all the time, and because there's nothing to stop it. And you think of these reindeer out there, that they're able to survive. It's just unbelievable.
And they don't sink in the snow like a moose would.
No, because they do have these big cup-shaped hooves, you know, that enable them to sort of more or less float. I mean, I think when the snow gets really deep, but they at some point they do start to sink in. But usually, when you see their, you know, you don't see when you see their tracks, you see the impression of the hoof. You don't see like it digging way deep down into the snow. I mean, I have to guess if they got into really deep snow, they would sink. But the other thing is that because their food is on the windblown areas, they really are going to try to stay in places where they don't really have to. They don't want to be digging down in the deep snow. And in fact, that's one of the big worries about climate change. It's not so much that the snow will get deep, but that that there'll be more icing and it'll be much more difficult for reindeer to dig in through the ice down to the lichen. I mean, I read that in preparing for that Audubon article. Mm-hmm. I read that an adult reindeer eats between 400 and 500 kilograms. That's like more than 1,000 pounds of lichen a year.
Really?
So, I mean,
that's a lot.
That's a lot of lichen, and actually, that's another big challenge for reindeer husbandry and also the wild reindeer is that they really have to make sure that given the fact that there has been loss of habitat to expansion of towns and also second home development is a really big issue here and in terms of reindeer habitat encroachment. And so what habitat there is, you know, they have to make sure that the reindeer don't overgraze the habitat. That's a really big issue.
I wanted to take you to the first time that you your first sighting of reindeer, and if you don't mind, I'm going to read your article because I just was so taken with this. So it said, "Fair weather and stiff winds welcome us on our first day's ski. We start on fresh snow that's slightly crunchy underfoot, like skiing on crushed Rice Krispies. 2 hours into our ski finds us topped out on the plateau proper, where the wind has quickened and the vistas have opened. We're stopped for a quick hot chocolate break when Doug shouts and points excitedly at a small hill nearby covered with funny pockmarks, fresh reindeer tracks. The prints loop and weave, broadening in places into parallel tracks, 10 to 15 animals wide, and then squeezing down to a bottleneck. They look like they've been stitched onto the slope by a crazy seamstress."
Yeah. Yeah, it's really, it is this amazing, like you look at it and you have to sort of wonder why, especially when the tracks go from really broad, you know, all the animals, you can imagine them all spread apart, and then they just narrow to like this, and there's no topographical reason for why the animals would have behaved in that way. It's really this amazing tapestry that's been stitched into the white of the snow. It is quite beautiful.
So it sounds like it's almost like mystical.
Yeah, well, it is. Well, you know that. Well, the thing to keep in mind, Laurel, is that you know, reindeer are, they've been hunted for, you know, in Norway at least since the glaciers left, you know, 8,000 years ago or whatever, and so they are very aware of humankind, and so they're really skitter. You know, you don't want to get, first of all, you don't want to get too close to them because you don't want to freak them out and make them use more energy than they have to use, but they're also intensely aware of people. So to be able to see reindeer even from a distance is just an amazing privilege to get to see this. And so often, what you're doing is you see their sign, you see these tracks, and when you do finally get to see the animals themselves, it's just it's magic, especially because they do, you don't hear them.
Yeah, so tell me about your first sighting. And I have to admit that at the beginning of the show, I have this creature call, and uh-huh. I was going to try and feature reindeer as the creature call, and I'm not going to, or I didn't, because I couldn't find any recordings of reindeer anywhere at all.
Well, you know, it's funny, actually. I do, they do make a noise. I think the males make a noise that's sort of like a grunting noise if you're close to them. But generally, you know, I think the snow muffles their movements, the sound of their movements. And so, you know, it's just, it's muffled. And plus it's windy. It's windy, so a lot of the sound is also sort of, you know, the wind is just a constant companion. And they seem to float. They just seem to float along on the landscape, and you know, to see them. And they tend to move. You know, they're coordinated in a they stay in smallish groups. I mean, they tend to be 100, 200 animals maybe.
What was it like the very first time you saw the wild reindeer on this trip?
Well, we actually saw them, I guess it was, we saw tracks for a few days. And then we were actually skiing along. We're probably, it was, I think it was our third day, maybe it was our fourth day out. I think it was our third day. Anyway, we're skiing along and we heard, there were some skiers actually going in the opposite direction, coming from this hut that we were headed to. And they said, "We saw some reindeer up ahead." And we're like, "Oh my God, you saw reindeer?" And, you know, you figure, oh, am I going to get to be that lucky? And then all of a sudden we saw, it almost looks like ants, a little bit like small ants, because you see them at a distance, you know, sort of this little cluster of dots moving on the snow. And they sort of, you know, it's like a round patch of this cluster of animals, and then maybe it thins and, you know, gets longer, and then it looks very organic, and it looks like their movements are all quite coordinated. And then if you get lucky, they'll come towards you or come closer to you. We saw them. We were down. They didn't smell us. We would have been upwind of them. So they weren't aware of us, and so we were able to get to see them. I don't know if you've seen the picture. You've seen the picture in the article. I mean, we're close enough to see their antlers and their ears distinctly, but we weren't close enough. You know, we were probably a couple hundred meters off, maybe. We were still a good distance off. So, and you just, you know, when we finally got to the point where we were skiing, they sort of ran across the ski trail, and then they went up on this hill, and that's when we got a fairly good look at them. And, you know, you just stop in your tracks. It's transfixed. You know how unusual it is to be able to actually see them like that. And, you know, they'll stop. So they ran across the trail, and they went up on this, as I said, on this sort of little ridge, and then they stopped to, you know, dig at the snow and eat, and you just sort of watch them, and they seem to move like a unit, and it's just amazing. And then what happened with us is they went up over this ridge. I think they heard us or heard a noise or something. Maybe they smelled, maybe the wind shifted.
So you see them up on the ridge.
Yeah, and then actually for us, what happened was something spooked them. You know, they heard either like my coat flapped or I don't know what happened, and they headed up the hill and out of sight, up to another place to graze. And then they were gone. That was basically our last time. We just saw a lot more tracks. So it's pretty, even though there are like 7,000 to 8,000 reindeer in this region, which, you know, so if you figure there are about 25,000 wild reindeer in Norway, I mean, that's, you know, this is the biggest, actually it's the biggest herd of wild reindeer in all of Europe. So it's surprisingly difficult to see them, and you also, you know, I mean, it's a bit of, like I said, it's a bit of a balancing act, because you can't chase them, you know, that's totally inappropriate. You just have to hope that by chance you get to see them.
In the article, you said reindeer watching in Hardangervidda involves a delicate dance.
Yeah, it is. It is, because you don't want to get too, you know, it's inappropriate to get too close. But you, of course, you know, you do want to see them. I mean, it's an amazing, you know, to think that these animals are able to survive and that their ancestors go back, you know, so far. I mean, these animals fed Vikings, you know. You know, there were Norwegians were hunting their great, you know, grandfathers and grandmothers 8,000 years ago, when the glaciers were just pulling off of the country, and it's just an amazing thing to think that the line goes back like that. That these are wild creatures,
and the same ones that maybe Roald Amundsen saw, you know, the great, 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 great,
or maybe the ones that he made his sleeping bag was made out of a reindeer hide, I think, at that point, for that particular trip. In fact, because his brother It's his brother. He, what happened to Amundsen was, they got, you know, they basically, there was this, he dug himself into a snow cave, and there had been a, there was a storm, and the cave iced over, and his reindeer for a sleeping bag, you know, there were a few hairs sticking up, and his brother somehow managed not to get iced into his little snow cave, because that's what people do here. Actually, everybody in Norway and skis with little snow shovels, because
oh, really?
If the weather comes, oh yeah, because if the weather comes down, you dig yourself a hole in the snow to, you know, because the snow is insulating.
Did you have to do that on this trip, or not?
No, we didn't. But we all we had shovels. We were a party of six. You know, my two kids, my husband, myself, and we Audubon sent a photographer and an assistant. So between us, I guess we had four shovels. So, and we had Ensolite pad, you know, we had pads and sleeping bags and down jackets. And
you're carrying all of it on your backs, yeah? Or do
right,
you have sleds
yes, yes.
that you're pulling?
Well, the photographer, Per Brehagen, he had a sled because he had to carry a lot of, you know, he brought two backup battery powered hard drives to back his photographs up on. And so he had a lot of heavy gear, but we tried to, I mean, we had, you know, down jackets and we had bivy sacks, these things called bivy sacks. I don't know if you know what they are, but they're like, it's like a sock to pull over. It's like a big waterproof sock that you use to pull over your sleeping bag. It's like, we didn't have a tent or anything, but it would be a bivy sack would be enough wind protection to sort of keep your sleeping bag dry and to protect you from the wind. And, you know, hopefully, God forbid, you should get snowed in. I mean, we did have one day where we were at a hut, our second to last hut, and we woke up, we skied in, and then we woke up the next morning. There was just no way, absolutely no way we were going anywhere. It was blowing really hard. It was snowing. There was zero visibility. You could barely go, like, out to the outhouse, you know, which is where the toilet was. And the dog, we brought our dog with us. The dog wouldn't even go outside.
You know it's bad when.
I know, when the dog doesn't want to go. So we hold up for a day with everybody, you know, everybody was there because nobody was going anywhere. And, you know, it was simply too dangerous. You'd get lost in a heartbeat.
I wanted to talk a little bit about the weather. And I know the weather can change really rapidly. And you said in the article something very curious, that storms are one reason Hardangervidda has proved so perfect for wild reindeer. Why is that?
Well, partly because the wind blows places clean, so it's easy for them to get to the lichen that they need to survive on in the winter, mm-hmm. and also because of this sort of the way that the storm tracks, they dump a lot of snow in the western part and then not so much in the eastern part. And so as I was explaining to you earlier, where they can sort of in the spring, they can follow this as the snow melts away. They can move west into the areas where the fresh green vegetation is coming up. You know, that first flush of energy that a plant puts into its growth is really often very nutrient rich. So the storms, the way that the storms distribute the snow is really helpful. And also, to some extent, they're such shy animals. I mean, it does tend to limit the number of people who go up there. You know, Hardangervidda is basically north of Oslo, and it's to the east of Bergen, which is the second largest city in Norway, and there's actually a train. You can take a train.
And is it a big tourist destination, or more like a remote, you know, just for the intrepid traveler?
Well, it's.
Or are all Norwegians intrepid travelers?
No, I wouldn't say all Norwegians. I mean, I think because it's accessible in that respect, mm-hmm. that it does attract people, but it would be hard to call it like a heavy tourist destination. Mm-hmm. That would be really pushing it.
And what you mentioned that Amundsen had had a reindeer, you know,
sleeping bag.
Sleeping bag. And so how have reindeer been used over the years? And are they still used? Are their products still used?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean the Sami, who are by law in Norway, the only Sami or people of Sami descent are the only people who can herd reindeer. So there's the wild reindeer, which are left as wild animals, and there is a hunt for reindeer to sort of keep their numbers. You know, the nature management, the government group that manages reindeer sets limits on the take to sort of keep numbers within carrying capacity for the habitat that is available to the reindeer. But
and then do you need a permit to hunt them? And can anyone hunt them?
Well, it's a lottery. I think it's a lottery. I can't remember, to be honest. Mm-hmm. And actually hunting is a whole nother. It's hunting. It's not hunting like in Vermont hunting. It's much. You have to do hunting. Vermont has got you have to have hunter education and so forth. But it's hunting is a little more restricted in Norway in terms of guns and so forth. But anyway, so people eat reindeer. You know, reindeer they're ruminants like cows, so people do eat reindeer and they do use their pelts for a lot of. People use them now they're often decorative, or people use them to sit, like people carry them rolled up pelts and sit on them in the wintertime, like you might sit on an Enslite pad or a Thermomesh pad.
Okay.
And the Sami use their antlers to make these beautiful, like they'll often use the antlers to make knife handles or other amazing artwork. You know, the Sami, the Lapps have developed amazing crafts using the bones and the antlers.
And then the antlers, that was something interesting about the antlers. Both males and females have antlers.
Yeah, that's really I think that's really interesting. One of the reasons for that is the males drop their antlers after rut, but the female keeps
her
antlers.
And that's in December? Is that
right? They would drop them in like December or something after the rut. But the females keep their antlers until after the calves are born, because they use them to keep the males away from the best spring feeding areas. Because in the winter, the reindeer, as I said, it's like 80% of their forage is lichen, and that's enough to keep them alive, but it doesn't give them the protein they need to grow. So in the spring, they're browsing on these, you know, herbs and grasses, and they like the young shoots of these little dwarf willows and dwarf spruces, willows and birches that grow on the tundra. But the females, they need that food even more than the males, and so they use their horns to keep the males away from the best grazing areas, and once the calves are born, to sort of give the calves a chance to get at the best food too.
Really?
So it's interesting. I mean, they may be the only sort of ruminants that where the females have antlers in addition to the males. I think that's right, but I'm not quite sure.
That's interesting, because I was going to ask you that, because in most deer species you don't have the females.
Yeah,
with antlers.
Yeah, and you see, actually, they drop them. I mean, you know, both males and females do drop their antlers. So I'm actually have two reindeer antlers. I'm just looking at them right on my desk.
And what do they look like? How big are they? What do they really look like?
Well, they're... All right, so I've got this male antler. They're They look much like a deer, like a white-tailed deer antler, I think. Mm-hmm. Although they don't get quite as big. I think a big male reindeer, you know, a really old male reindeer would have one that was quite, maybe it'd be a foot and a half, you know, like if you were to measure it from one end to the other, it might be a foot and a half feet long. But, you know, they tend to be sort of thinner overall. Like they don't get fat between, like they don't have fat parts on the antler between the joints. They tend to be quite slender. So they're almost, I wouldn't call them lacy, but they're much more delicate than what I think of. Although I have seen pictures of, you know, very big bucks with extremely big antlers. But again, they don't tend to be thick anywhere. They tend to be, if they're large, they tend to be still somewhat thin and, I guess, lacy.
And then do the female antlers are smaller than the male antlers in general?
Yeah, the female antlers are usually only, you know, a third of the size maybe. Hmm. So they tend to be much, much smaller. But they're enough to keep the males in line. Maybe you and I could use a pair.
Yeah. I love it. And then,
no, I don't know.
And then just recently, it's been interesting because in September, I wanted to talk about climate change and how climate change affects reindeer. And here in the States, in September 2009, the International Fund for Animal Welfare, also known as IFAW, petitioned the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to list two high Arctic caribou species on the Endangered Species Act. And namely, the two species are the Peary and Dolphin Union caribou. Specifically because they said those species were threatened with extinction by the effects of global climate change. And I just was wondering, you know, is how the climate change is affecting reindeer. You had mentioned that it's not really the snow aspect, but more the icing aspect.
Right. Well, it's interesting you ask that because I think that, you know, Norway takes its responsibility as sort of guardians of this wild stock quite seriously. And so this is a question that they have asked actively. Okay, we know climate is changing. We're in the Arctic and subarctic here, and so it's really the effects are much more pronounced. Climate change effects are much more pronounced at the poles than they are at the equator. And so they know that these temperature changes are coming and that there are going to be changes in precipitation patterns. So they've actually done studies to say, okay, what are we looking at? And the big thing is that this potential for icing is a major problem. And also that depending upon how temperatures do change, there's this potential, this tundra vegetation, lichen vegetation in particular, is a tundra species. It does require, you know, certain temperatures and so forth. And so the expectation is, at least in these sort of what they call, they have like a reindeer 2030 report where they're looking at what's the future, what's the potential for wild reindeer in Norway. What they realize is that they're going to have to try to provide a lot more area for reindeer to find enough lichen to survive on, because the habits, you know, whether that means they'll be reduced numbers overall, or whether there's certainly been a lot of talk here about trying to cut back on the number of second homes, what they call huts. They're not really huts, they're like little mountain cabins, you know, that there's talk about perhaps the government should buy up some of the huts and, you know, basically move people out so that reindeer are able to move more easily and look more broadly for suitable food and suitable habitat.
So is that, what are some of the major threats for reindeer? Is it this, this boom in vacation home construction that's sort of nibbling away at the habitat? Or
I think that's probably, if that's certainly a major threat probably the biggest one is just that they're, you know, they're getting like every other, like every other species in a that's not that's bounded by in a place that's bounded by people. Even though Norway is, you know, there's only like 4.7 million Norwegians, and we're certainly not a very populous country. There is, reindeer are so skittish that, you know, they've been hunted for so many millennia that they really don't tolerate contact with people all that well, and so having these second home development is a big issue.
And given that they don't tolerate contact with people, how were they domesticated? And, you know, are they really two separate types of reindeer, or, you know, what's the difference between domesticated reindeer and wild reindeer?
Well, you know, that's a good question. I don't know how. I mean, I don't know how they were domesticated. I mean, I assume that, you know, that the Samis captured some of them and found a way to, you know, breed for gentler individuals who are willing to, you know, because the Samis use them. They have harnesses. They use them to pull sledges and stuff.
Really?
And they in fact, reindeer have been domesticated longer than the horse.
Really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, so they, and the Samis use them like horses, basically. I mean, they don't ride them. They're not strong enough to, I've never seen a Sami ride a reindeer, but reindeer do pull sleds. I think if you were to look at the main difference you would notice is size, you know, because I think that the domestic animals have been bred for size, because, I mean, you can go to any grocery store in Norway and buy reindeer meat, you know, reindeer, you can buy cuts of meat from a reindeer. It's everywhere.
And what does it taste like? Just like venison?
No, it doesn't really taste like venison. What's the joke? Tastes like chicken. No. No, it doesn't taste like chicken. Let's see. What does it taste like? It tastes like a very lean beef. It's extremely lean. It's not rich, but it's got a very complex flavor. It's quite distinct. It's really good. I'm not a big, actually, I'm mostly vegetarian at this point, but it's really if you're a meat eater, it's a flavor that's, you know, especially since, you know, these are domesticated animals that are being raised for food production. It's really a flavor. It's really a taste you ought to try if you eat meat.
And then can you also find pelts and things in the stores very easily?
You can find pelts. Yep, you can find pelts at, like, I could go to an outdoor store here, and right in the place where they sell, like, you know, Therm-a-Rest pads, you can also find a little pile of reindeer pelts. And often the Sami will come. You can also buy them, like, Sami will have little shops, or, like, in the summer, the northern Sami or the western Sami, you know, the Lapp people will come and set up temporary shops where you can buy pelts and stuff, and knives. Like, they'll often sell, they make their own knives and they decorate the handles, and so they'll sell handcrafts.
Like, we can buy sheepskin here around here.
Exactly, exactly. That's exactly what it's like. So just like in Vermont, I mean, you wouldn't find sheepskins everywhere, and actually, you wouldn't take a sheepskin outside, but it would be totally normal here to go hiking in the public forests. Like Trondheim has two big public forests on either side of the city. And there's a real tradition here of going hiking, going for little walks in the forest with your kids on Sunday. Everything's shut. You know, there's no businesses are open, so everybody just takes the day off and goes for a walk or ski. And it would be totally normal to see the dad with a backpack on or the mom with a reindeer skin rolled up, and they would just drop the pelt down on the ground for the kids to sit on and have a lunch break or something. Because remember, this fur is very thick and it's really insulating. So it's as good as sitting on a, you know, some synthetic thing, although I actually myself don't carry one.
And then have you been pulled by a sleigh with reindeer?
I have not. No, I have not. although there is, it's actually, it's something I really wanted to do is to, the Sami culture here is it's really interesting. It's really, it's quite complex. And there is a group of Sami about 2.5 hours from the town where I live, where they're actively herding reindeer and sort of living a somewhat traditional Sami existence where their income mainly comes from reindeer herding. And they're semi-nomadic, you know, because they have to, you know, it's not like a cow where you sort of throw them a bale of hay in the winter. I mean, these animals, you know, they don't have bales of lichen to toss them.
And how, is the government helping to protect that culture?
Oh, very much so. In fact, I was just looking on the web, sort of looking at what's the latest update, what's the latest reindeer update in terms of management of domestic animals, and they have just paid out this year. So Norway tries to support this culture in part by saying, okay, if you lose animals if you lose reindeer to wild animals, mainly here, lynx is one of the main predators. There are wolves, but not enough to really make a difference for reindeer. But anyway, there were about 20,000 deer were killed this year by wild animals, and Norway paid out 57 million kroner, which is about 10 million U.S. dollars in compensation to reindeer herders.
Oh, really?
So in that respect, they support them, and also, in part, just by sort of government protection, saying, okay, only Sami can have the right to be, you know, to herd reindeer, to herd domestic reindeer.
So the big question, whether it's domestic or wild, is can reindeer fly?
Yeah, well, it looks that way. Because you can't believe that many animals can move so swiftly and so silently. It does. It looks like they're sort of just flying across the landscape.
I actually do want to read you one thing you wrote that was so captivating.
Okay.
And it was about, 300, when you saw 300 reindeer, you know, from the distance, and you said 300
right.
reindeer are close enough, yet far enough away for us to make out the dark of their muzzles and the flicking of their ears in the wind. They nibble here and paw there, moving in unison across snow-dyed and icy indigo by the shade of the hills above. Spindrift smears the animals' feet and blurs their outlines, adding to the sense that they're a single organism. We're absolutely silent, and the wind is in our favor, but it can't last. Sure enough, after 15 minutes, a rogue gust wafts our scent to the reindeer, and 300 heads startle to attention. The animals begin to run upslope. The snow swallows the sound of their hooves, and they skim across the landscape with a fluidity that defies gravity. I know now where the Santa myth began. Reindeer really can fly.
But of course they can fly. Well, don't you believe in Santa Claus?
I do. And I just wanted you to tell me how, when you saw that, you just saw them take off into the air from there.
Yeah. Well, what about, I told you about Peer Gynt, you know, Henrik Ibsen's play, Peer Gynt. Because one of the famous scenes in there is where he's talking to his mother, and she's sort of saying, "What were you, you lazy bones? What were you doing?" And he tells her this fantastic tale, where he talks about getting on a reindeer and riding it as it takes off in the air across this. Actually, it's this very famous hiking ridge, this beautiful ridge walk called Bessigen. So Peer Gynt, he's a character in a Henrik Ibsen play, you know, a famous Norwegian playwright. Mm-hmm. So everybody in Norway knows Peer Gynt, and everybody knows about his famous ride on the back of a reindeer. So reindeer must be able to fly.
So that's a great way to end this. thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me.
Okay, well, good luck.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation about reindeer with former Vermonter Nancy Bazalchuk, a freelance science writer and editor now living in Norway, who used to work the environmental beat at the Burlington Free Press. Now, let me play you today's creature call once again and see if you've guessed it correctly. The animals that make these sounds are large mammals that are common across Vermont. While not a reindeer, they are another species of ungulate. Do you know what kind? It's a white-tailed deer. You can find white-tailed deer throughout North America. In fact, there might be as many as 15 million of them in the United States. They're widespread in part because they're adaptable in what they eat. They feed on leaves, twigs, shoots, acorns, berries, and seeds, and they also graze on grasses. Often when we see them, they're running away from us. Next time you come across one, notice how it springs forward with each bound and pushes off with its hind legs and lands on its front feet. Take a close look, too, at its antlers. If you're close enough, you may notice how the main beam grows forward rather than upwards, and that each tine develops as its own separate branch rather than being split into a forked pair. Once again, here's the sound of white-tailed deer. This sound is from a buck trying to intimidate others and prevent a fight. For next week's Creature Call, I'll move to the Midwest United States, where scientists are saving these endangered birds from extinction. Now, here's your preview. Be sure to tune in next week when I'll replay this strange sound from the wild world and reveal the animal that made it. Next week, I'll also talk with Matt Mendenhall, associate editor of Birders World magazine. We'll talk about whooping cranes, what makes them special, how these birds are making a comeback from a population of just 16 individuals, and how scientists have taught whooping cranes to migrate using ultralight planes. Archived episodes of The Wildlife are available on iTunes, at my website, laurelnemi.com, and at laurelnemi.podbean.com. You can stream The Wildlife live at theradiator.org every Monday from 1 to 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And, of course, if you have comments about this show or ideas for future ones, you can email me at laurel@laurelnemi.com. This has been The Wildlife. I'm your host, Laurel Nemi, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM LP, in Burlington, Vermont.